What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the outstanding writer Alice Hoffman, author of the best-selling book on Masadah, The Dovekeepers. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Spring has certainly sprung here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live in the American Southwest. That makes perfect sense in a Jewish way, since we are now between the two great springtime festivals, Purim and Pesach, having celebrated Purim last week and looking forward to Passover, beginning April 6th. Actually, if you didn't get enough of the great festival of fun, frolic, and frivolity, my own congregation, Temple Emmanuel, has its annual Purim extravaganza and carnival today at 10 a.m., conveniently timed for just after the conclusion of our Too Jewish broadcast. We are parodying Beauty and the Beast. We call it Beauty and the Feast of Purim. And it's an incredible work of great talent and humor and music, if I must say so myself, which I must. All of this raises the interesting question of just when Jews actually celebrate the elaborate roster of holidays we have and for how long. The most common Jewish holiday, of course, is Shabbat, the weekly Sabbath, which begins at sundown Friday night and continues to sundown Saturday. Shabbat also constitutes the most important festival, in part because it happens so regularly that it requires that we actually focus on our spiritual lives for at least one day a week. But in a way, that's the easiest holiday to accommodate. All Jews agree that we celebrate Shabbat Friday and Saturday. How we each celebrate it is another matter, but no one thinks it should be moved to, say, Tuesday on one week to make it more popular. For Orthodox Jews and all Jews living in Israel, the only Jewish country in the whole world, there is also no issue at all as to when we celebrate all the other holidays. The major holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Simchat Torah, Chanukah and Purim, Pesach and Shavuot, all come whenever they happen to fall on the lunar calendar, the moon calendar used to calculate all Jewish festivals as opposed to our solar calendar here in America, and the festivals are observed on those dates without exception, if you are Orthodox. The minor festivals and commemorations, like Tu B'Shvat and Tisha B'Av and Yom HaTzmaut and Lag B'Omer, are only changed when they happen to fall on Shabbat, and then they're just moved a day later. That seems simple enough, although actually it's not quite that easy. For those Orthodox Jews living outside of Israel, certain major festivals get an added day thrown in as a way to cover the challenge of fulfilling that holiday in the diaspora. That makes certain festivals last a day longer, 2 days for Rosh Hashanah, 8 days for Sukkot instead of seven, 8 days for Passover, 2 days for Shavuot. Conservative Jews theoretically also observe these extra festival days. Conservative synagogues, even small ones, rarely change festival celebration dates to accommodate the needs of congregants in other areas. But now, the real issue comes up when you get to Reform and other more religiously liberal Jews. For us, the major festivals fall when they fall. Rosh Hashanah is celebrated on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur commemorated on Yom Kippur, and the first Seder takes place on the first night of Passover every year. And of course, Hanukkah happens when Hanukkah happens, whether it's in the middle of December or at the very end overlapping January, or even, as it will be in 2013, believe it or not, starting Thanksgiving weekend in November. But a long-standing Reform custom, especially in smaller and more remote communities, is to celebrate the less obviously major festivals on the Shabbat that falls most close to the holiday, or on the day that works best for the largest number of Jews. This applies particularly to holidays like Purim, Shavuot, Tu B'Shvat, sometimes even the bigger Hanukkah celebrations, and sometimes even a Passover Seder. When you serve as a student rabbi in a remote congregation, during my seminary years I served in Billings, Montana, Sydney, Australia, and later Pine Bluff, Arkansas, obviously not all at the same time, you end up celebrating most of the holidays on the Friday night you're in town, even if the actual festival date is earlier or later. So far as I could tell, no one's Judaism is really ruined by the experience of moving the festival. But it's pretty odd if you're used to a larger and more active Jewish community, more committed to keeping the dates at, you know, the right time. But even in bigger, more active Jewish places, there are choices to be made. So this year, when Purim fell on a Wednesday night, Reform congregations everywhere had to decide when they were going to be doing their annual Purim celebrations, a big show and a carnival usually. And since we all want as many people to be able to come as possible, it's always best to do that on a weekend closest to Purim. So this year in my own Temple Emmanuel, largest congregation in Tucson and the historic congregation in the whole state, we did our regular Megillah reading with all its silliness on Wednesday night, the actual night of Purim. And then we'll celebrate our show and carnival this morning, actually a few days after Purim. In a way, this makes us pretty normal in the Reform world. But in another sense, it also makes us nearly revolutionary. We are basically changing a calendar that was fixed in the time of the Talmud 1,600 years ago by the rabbis. Not a small endeavor. But we are trying to make Judaism available and accessible to everyone. And that cannot be anything but a positive. To toast that effort and to play us in this morning, and in a last tribute to the happiest Jewish holiday of all, Purim, here's the Maccabees parody of Pink's Raise Your Glass, which doesn't need much changing to fit Purim, and which was kind of similar to the Ein Prat cut we played at the end of last week's show. Look, you gotta have some continuity in your Judaism, right? Even in the shticks.
Stand for a tale so grand. Shushan is the place where it all began. The hidden miracle. One man, second in command, slay all the Jews with his wicked plan. A scheme so miserable. He chose a day for the disaster. It's ironic what came after. He didn't know a girl named Esther would turn it upside down. So raise your glass. God was pulling strings from behind the scenes. She wore the royal crown. 3 days the Jews just prayed. Queen Esther risked her life, went to save the day. She took Haman down. The streets were filled with celebration. Everyone ate Haman Tashin. Jubilation for the nation. K-T-L-A-N-U.
That was the Maccabees version of Raise Your Glass for Purim last week or this morning at Temple Emmanuel at 10 a.m. Our guest this morning is an outstanding author, Alice Hoffman, a major literary figure who had never before written about a Jewish subject, even though she's Jewish. Find out why she chose to do so and what her publishing sensation, The Dove Keepers, is all about when we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments.
Hi, Joe Spina of Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, "To find balance in life is to find happiness." Now, I assume he was a smart guy, being a philosopher and all. So it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza, too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this. What one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese, heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce, crispy crust or lightly done crust. It's all in balance for each customer. And as Gerarducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, author Alice Huffman. She's from New York, grew up on Long Island, and has become one of the more prominent authors in the United States, in particular with her work, The Dove Keepers, which has been called a major contribution to 21st century literature by no less than Toni Morrison. It is the story of the survivors of Masada and is considered to be her masterpiece. She has been writing for a long time, has written both novels and screenplays and short stories and, well, all kinds of stuff. We're delighted to welcome Alice Huffman. Good morning, Alice.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Tell us a little bit about what caused you to write The Dove Keepers.
Well, it came as a complete surprise to me. I did not expect to write this book, and I probably shouldn't have written this book because, you know, I really, although I'm Jewish, I really had no knowledge about our traditions at all. I knew nothing about the Bible. I knew nothing about history. I knew nothing about the Roman Empire. And two things happened to me. You know, one thing was that my son started to go to Israel. He's an archaeology student, and he started to come back with stories about his experiences there that really were so interesting to me because I felt that being an archaeologist and being a novelist were very related, that you're really searching for clues of how to build a world. And then the other thing is several members of my family live in Israel, and I had been there before, but I had never been to Masada. And so I went to Masada. I went to the site, and that completely changed everything for me.
You know, you never really dealt deeply with Jewish themes. You have 21 novels, 3 books of short stories, 8 books for kids and young adults. So, you know, you might as well start at the top, literally, with Masada.
That's true. You know, I've never dealt with Jewish themes, although I feel that my being Jewish really permeates my books and that I really, you know, became a writer because my grandmother told me stories. And, you know, I come from that tradition of, you know, storytelling, you know, by grandmothers to grandchildren and the stories of growing up in Russia and her experiences. So I always felt that was kind of just beneath the surface.
When you began to do research, and I don't want to just focus on The Dove Keepers, you've done so much extraordinary work, but what drew you directly into the heart of the story?
Well, I think what happened to me is when I was visiting, it was very hot. Nobody told me don't go in August. It was, you know, 110 degrees. I was there with my sister-in-law and brother-in-law, and we were the only people there. We were the first people up, the only people there. And I felt like, you know, I experienced something that I hadn't experienced, and I felt a kind of spiritual awakening in that instant of walking through those rooms and a real connection to the women who came before me, and I had never really felt that before.
We will talk much more with author Alice Huffman when we come back on Too Jewish this morning.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels' family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance, and I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Cohen is coming up fast, May 30th to June 10th, 2012. If you'd like to go with me on this fantastic journey to the Holy Land, email twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and registration information. After our fabulous Purim spiel this morning at 10 a.m. at Temple Emmanuel called Beauty and the Feast, our magnificent carnival will follow, and then we will finally put Purim in our rearview mirror, which means it's time to prepare for Pesach. That's right, as hard as it is to believe, it's only 3 weeks until Passover, the ultimate festival of freedom. To get us started on our pre-Pesach preview of Passover music, here's a favorite cut from the three Jewish tenors, a tribute to the late Moshe Oysher, Ki Lo Na'eh and Chad Gadya, two great Passover songs.
Yeah, but I'm a beaver.
That was Cantor's Abe Mizrahi, David Propus, and Mayor Finkelstein singing Ki Lo Na'eh and Chag Gadyah for the coming holiday of Matzah and Freedom, Passover, which starts April 6th. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
There has been a controversy about the Islamic authority over the Temple Mount. Temple Mount, of course, the site of both the First and Second Temple in Jerusalem, and the Dome of the Rock, a Muslim monument by tradition, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is as well, one of the holier mosques in Islam, because Muhammad's night journey had connections to it. The Waqf is the controlling authority over the Temple Mount, and they've been doing what they call archaeological explorations, but the Israeli Antiquities Authority has a different view of what they've been doing up there. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, basically looking at the last, well, since 1967, basically, the Waqf, the Muslim authority controlling Al-Aqsa and Dome of the Rock, have been quite systematically working to destroy basically any remains of Jewish presence on Temple Mount. Simply saying, they've been creating kind of constructions or renovations, but through doing those constructions and renovation, they actually focused on trying to dig out any remains of the Second Temple and getting rid of them. And unfortunately, I must admit, the Israeli government did not do much about it most of the years because of that issue being that delicate. You know, the other day when at those days member Knesset Ariel Sharon wanted to pay a visit, you might say, to Temple Mount, and of course he had his political agenda. He didn't do it out of
religious motivation, because of course religiously many Talmudic traditions say you can't even set foot on the Temple Mount because you might be, you know, it's too sacred a place for Jews and so on.
Right,
but that wasn't Sharon's motivation in any case.
Right, but the bottom line was that he went there on a visit.
Right.
That on any other circumstances, people would probably ignore and say, okay, let him visit for 1 hour. He will go and nothing happens. The reaction within the Arab world and led by the Waqf from Jerusalem was of huge riots all across, including Arab Israelis and Palestinians and many more.
Right, I mean, they called it the Temple Mount Intifada, actually, that followed.
So, and that's for only a visit. So, unfortunately, I need to admit that it seems that the Israeli police and law enforcement are not really capable of enforcing the archaeological laws that will prevent that kind of destruction. And even going into Temple Mount to check whether or not historical and archaeological sites that are extremely important to the Jewish people, and I would mention also to the Christian people, because there are a lot of churches. There were churches that were built on top of the remains of the Second Temple, and on top of those churches, Al-Aqsa was built. So when they're digging into the ground at those places, and they're bringing a shufal or a D9 or of any sort and digging in, any dig would ruin extremely important historical evidence that are extremely important, I think, to the entire Western world.
You know, it's ironic that the Israeli Antiquities Authority, which is really one of the fine institutions in Israel, works very hard to protect and preserve archaeological sites all over Israel. But in what must be considered the most important archaeological site in the world for Jews and one of the most important for Christians, they're sort of powerless to do anything to protect against this kind of depredation.
And we need to admit also on the other side that one of the reasons they can't do much about that is also the Jewish extreme ultra-Orthodox movement, the Haredim,
right,
who refer to this area as being extremely holy. So going and digging an archaeological dig there would be referred by them as being sacrilegious. I also think that some of them might be a little bit concerned regarding what those archaeological diggings might find.
Yeah, may not match with what they think happened.
Is Judaism.
Right.
Okay.
Fascinating. Thanks, guy. I remember going up on the Temple Mount in 1976 when I was a kid, and it was easy to do it, and you walked all around, and, you know, yeah, you might be stepping on the Holy of Holies, but nobody really thought much about it. So it's very interesting. The site's been there a long time, and our response is what's changed. Thanks, guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our two Jewish expert in the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Russia and maybe the potential Russian spring to match the Arab spring. And you mentioned an article Tom Friedman wrote about the politics of dignity.
Yeah, there was a very interesting op-ed piece, I think in early February, if I'm not mistaken, roughly a month ago, where Friedman did one of his, you know, fake memos as if he were writing to President Putin and the military guys who are in power in Egypt and saying, gentlemen, pay attention. You may not think you have much in common, but you do, and it has to do with the politics of dignity. People are tired of being treated like dirt. They want to be consulted. They want to be involved in determining or defining or shaping their own futures. And he was particularly harsh in his castigation of Putin for formulating a plan jointly with Medvedev, which basically gives him another 12 years in power without even presenting an argument to the people, without asking for their mandate or without trying to persuade them that his cause was just. And he basically says people are tired of being treated like they don't matter. And what's interesting about this is if you look around the Arab world and see which countries have revolted and changed forms of government, it is often where people were treated most badly and where they were consulted least. It's not necessarily countries that were poorest or countries with the highest unemployment rate. It's countries where people felt that the system robbed them of dignity. And there's a very interesting insight here, because if you look at Jewish history, very often where Jews fared the worst and experienced one type or another of bondage, of slavery, what was really at stake was whether they were treated with dignity or not. When we were slaves in Egypt, certainly we were deprived of dignity. And as we begin to think about Pesach and the story of the Exodus and the Haggadah, one way of looking at this is how many commandments in the Torah are related to treating people with dignity and treating life with intrinsic dignity? And what did we suffer when we were deprived of dignity? And there were many other cases throughout Christian Europe in the Middle Ages, certainly during the Inquisition, certainly during the Tsarist years in Russia, where Jews were essentially deprived of any form of human dignity. And generally speaking, we did not respond with armed revolts or mass demonstrations in Tahrir Square.
Yeah, we didn't really quite have the capacity to do so.
Well, but what we did instead was we looked inward and we created new philosophical systems. We created Kabbalah. We created the Talmud. We took the indignity and we built something that made us feel more dignified and more blessed and more special as human beings, right. Which is, of course, another way to react.
Very, very interesting psychosocial analysis. In other words, what we did is take this outward inability to rise in the world and the indignity heaped upon us and create our own structures of self-affirmation. And in doing so, created some of the most enduring intellectual constructs of that affirm dignity and holiness in the world. Really interesting. We will talk maybe more about this theme next time. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Becky was very proud of being Jewish and had lots of Jewish bumper stickers, Jewish stars, pro-Israel slogans, and the like on her car. And she also loved to volunteer for Jewish projects. She belonged to Bikur Cholim, the caring community temple group devoted to visiting and helping sick members of her congregation. One day, Becky was out making rounds visiting housebound patients. Unfortunately, she ran out of gas. As luck would have it, a gas station was just a block away. She walked to the station to borrow a gas can and get some gas, but the attendant didn't have one. Well, since she was in a hurry, she went back to her car to look for something she could fill with gas. And she saw the bedpan she had on hand for needy patients. She took the bedpan back to the gas station, filled it, and very carefully carried it back to her car. As she was pouring gas from the bedpan into her gas tank, two nuns watched her from across the street. One turned to the other and said, "If it starts, I'm converting to Judaism." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. You should live and be well, and don't forget to pour the last drops. This week's double portion of Vayakhel Pkudei, the conclusion of the Book of Exodus, deals with the creation and completion of the tabernacle in the wilderness, the consecration of the first central worship sanctuary for the people of Israel. Vayakhel et ha'am, the text has it. Moses assembled the people, called them together, and asked them on God's behalf to bring forward the finest objects they possessed to create the tabernacle in which the whole people could worship God in holiness. And the people gave the best they had. Gold and silver, precious stones and materials used to create a beautiful sanctuary, one they could be proud of and one which they believed would lend itself to the perpetuation of beauty and sanctity. Then Moses invited these artisans, wise in the ways of working with beautiful items, to come forward and create a structure embodying what God saw as appropriate for a sanctuary. In particular, Moses explained that God has called by name a man named Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, whom God filled with the Spirit of the Lord in wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and all manner of skilled workmanship, filled with the wisdom of the heart, that he might teach and work with every wise-hearted person in this sacred work. When the work was complete, they created a tabernacle in which God immediately brought the divine presence, a place of profound sacredness for our ancestors. You know, I love that phrase. For those skilled in the work of the hands, wise-hearted men and women who can create beauty and elegance to serve God in this world. Wise-hearted. Each of us has different skills. Some sing, some dance, some speak eloquently, and some of us create works of art and practical beauty with our hands. Each of us can contribute to the creation of holiness in this world by applying those skills to holy work. And when we do, we too have the potential to bring God's presence into our midst, into our ordinary, practical world, and thus make it sacred. May we each use our skills this week to make our lives and our world a little holier. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Alice Hoffman, will explore her great novel, The Dove Keepers, and let us know what will be coming next. Find out when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K through 12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In advance of the AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C., President Obama rejected the notion of simply containing the nuclear Iran, saying that such a prospect was intolerable. "I think the Israeli government recognizes that. As President of the United States, I don't bluff," Obama said in an Oval Office interview. "I also don't, as a matter of sound policy, go around advertising exactly what our intentions are, but I think both the Iranian and the Israeli governments recognize that when the United States says it is unacceptable for Iran to have a nuclear weapon, we mean what we say." Jeffrey Goldberg, who did the interview, pressed Obama on whether he thought Iran could be contained, a strategy the Israeli government opposes, and Obama insisted containment was not an option. "It will not be tolerable to a number of states in that region for Iran to have a nuclear weapon and them not to have a nuclear weapon," Obama said. "Iran is known to sponsor terrorist organizations, so the threat of proliferation becomes that much more severe. It is important for us to see that if we can solve this thing permanently as opposed to temporarily, the only way historically that a country has ultimately decided not to get nuclear weapons without constant military intervention has been when they themselves take nuclear weapons off the table." Obama also said that reports of differences between him and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are blown out of proportion. "In terms of Israeli politics, there's been a view that regardless of whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration, the working assumption is we've got Israel's back. And that's something I constantly try to reinforce and remind people of." At the AIPAC conference itself, Obama was even more forthright about his support for Israel. That has not changed Mitt Romney's perception of Obama's commitment to Israel, however, as The Daily Show with Jon Stewart demonstrated.
Israel looks at President Obama and they do not see a friend.
That's why people like myself believe that he threw Israel under the bus.
"Whereas I, Mitt Romney, will gladly retrieve Israel from under that bus and posthumously baptize it."
I see. Very funny. In other news, there is further evidence that anti-Semitism can come back at the weirdest times and places in Hungary. For example, award-winning Hungarian Jewish writer Ákos Kertész has confirmed that he has applied for political asylum in Canada. Harassment and threats followed the author's controversial statements last summer about Hungary's role in the Holocaust. Now he's leaving. Kertész, 80 years old and the winner of Hungary's most prestigious literary prize, the Kossuth, left for Canada last week. He said in a statement released to the media that a political campaign was mounted against me, not only by the Budapest City Hall, but also from within the government and parliament. Writing in the American-Hungarian language newspaper Amerikai Népszava, Kertész said that Hungarians alone can now be blamed for the Holocaust because they, unlike the Germans, have failed to admit and repent for their crimes. He also referred to Hungarians as genetically subservient because they do not feel the slightest remorse for the gravest of historical crimes. They shift their responsibility to others and always put the blame on others. Kertész later cut the phrase genetically subservient from his article, but that did not prevent the Budapest City Council from stripping him of its honorary citizenship. He also said that the current right-wing government has launched a witch hunt and fueled the extremists, and he has been subject to constant harassment and threats, attacked on the street, and he thought his own life was in jeopardy. In other news, after grabbing national headlines with its push for a pre-Shabbat starting time, the Robert Barron Academy of Houston registered a decisive win over Dallas Covenant and secured a spot in the Texas State 2A private and parochial boys basketball state championship game. The Texas Association of Private and Parochial Schools, known as TAPS, originally ruled that the game would be played at its original 9 p.m. starting time on a Friday, after Shabbat had begun. Barron, a modern Orthodox school, would have had to forfeit without changing the schedule. But TAPS reversed itself just hours after the announcement that Barron's team captain, along with teammates and parents, had enlisted the support of prominent Washington attorney Nathan Lewin and filed a lawsuit against the association. The championship game was originally set for 2 o'clock on Saturday. Of course, that also conflicted with Shabbat. Game was ultimately played at 9 p.m. The Barron Academy said, "We are thankful to the TAPS Association for ultimately making the right decision." Barron's plight made international headlines and garnered support from several public figures, including the mayor of Houston, former Rockets coach Jeff Van Gundy, and U.S. Senator John Cornyn. No word on whether Mitt Romney spoke out on it. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, the distinguished author Alice Hoffman. She has written 21 novels, 3 books of short fiction, 8 books for children and young adults, really most magnificent novel, The Dove Keepers Set at Masada, which has been called really one of the masterpieces of, the last century or so, certainly over the last 25 years. You have always had a fascination with magic, it seems to me. Where'd that come from?
I'm not sure where that came from. Again, I think it was, from reading fairy tales and from hearing these folk tales from my grandmother, hearing Russian folk tales about Baba Yaga. And then when I started to read, I always read books that had magic in them. And I just feel, I feel like magic is part of literature and it always has been. You know, when I started to do research for the Dove Keepers, I was actually really shocked by how much magic I found, because it wasn't really magic. You know, magic and medicine and spirituality, it was so intertwined. There wasn't this big schism between them. It was all of one piece, really.
You know, I think what I really liked, among the many things I really liked at the Dove Keepers, was the way that you understood that science and magic were kind of the same thing in the ancient world. People didn't have that distinction.
Yeah, it's really true. You know, I the only other book that I really have written that's really about Jewish themes is a book for teens called Incantation,
right,
which is it's set in the Inquisition. And again, you know, when they outlawed books, they outlawed, religious books, medical books, and magic books. So I think medicine and magic have been linked for a long time.
You've had books made into films. What's that process like?
That is a strange process, I have to say. You know, I also was a screenwriter and for a long time, so I knew when I sold my books and I wasn't going to be involved, they were no longer going to belong to me. So it's both a great experience, you know, to see your work come alive and people saying your words and, you know, seeing the house that you wrote about built and created, but it's also, you know, you lose control. And as a novelist, you're really kind of in complete control. And in a movie, really, you don't have any control.
You wrote a kind of a reworking of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights for Here on Earth, which was chosen by Oprah, which is a very nice thing when Oprah chooses a book for you.
Yes, very.
Who else influenced you besides Bronte?
Well, Bronte was a huge influence on me. And, you know, it's funny, you know, I didn't
By the
really
way, I have to say, I always thought Wuthering Heights needed a reworking, but that's just me.
Well, you know, Wuthering Heights is very complicated. I actually feel that about Jane Eyre. I think you're either like a Jane Eyre person or a Wuthering Heights
person. Yeah, I think I'm more Jane Eyre than Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, see, I think that needed a reworking, but and I always related to the Mad Woman in the Attic. But
yeah, that's
funny. You know, I was very influenced by fantasy and science fiction. Really I think Rod Serling had a huge influence on me. Watching The Twilight Zone when I was young, I thought he was a genius. And Ray Bradbury, who is still alive at 91 and still writing,
yeah.
You know, they really influenced me. But actually, recently I was asked, you know, who was the person who influenced me most as a young woman writer? And really, but I realized that it was Anne Frank, because reading The Diary was really, when I was young, the only voice of a young Jewish woman that I had read. And that was it. And so it was the whole idea of her longing to be a writer and her having this kind of secret self that I think I related to so strongly, and the intensity and the intimate nature of the book, you know. And I just felt that, you know, maybe I could write. That was the first glimmering where I felt that maybe I could write.
Well, you certainly could. Dove Keepers, by the way, I got to you because my wife insisted I keep trying, so...
well, thank her for me.
Wendy, thank you very much.
In writing The Dove Keepers, what was the most challenging part of creating that book, which is, I mean, it's a very nuanced, multi-level kind of book.
Well, thank you. I mean, the huge undertaking was the research I had to do. And I realized, there came a point where I realized that I could actually research the book for the rest of my life, that there was so much material that I could never hope to know, not only not know it all, but I could never even begin to grasp a small part of it. And after that, I just thought, you know, I just have to know what my characters know. I don't have to know everything about, you know, the Roman world, the ancient world. I just have to know what they know. And it was kind of freeing to feel that way. And I had people who were very helpful to me who read the manuscript. And I was a visiting scholar at Brandeis and could use the libraries. But for me, that was the most daunting thing. And then to try to give these women a voice and to, you know, that felt like a big weight, because I wanted to do it right for them.
How do you kind of try to get into the mind of someone living 2,000 years ago, nearly, you know, 1,950 years ago? When do you feel like you really are speaking with their authentic voice?
It took a while. You know, I do a lot of revision, and for many, you know, variations of this book, it didn't feel like that. It felt forced. But the more I wrote it, and the more I let myself be kind of taken over by the consciousness of these four women, the more I felt that the voice was authentic.
You know, there are some very popular books that are kind of historical fiction. I think of one which shall remain nameless, written by a person I really like, who's a good nonfiction author, and where the voices just don't ever sound like real people.
I know what you're saying, because really, you know, I came to this book not being a historian, and, you know, I think
might have been
in a way
an advantage.
That was helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was helpful for me.
Do you like writing teen novels better or grown-up novels better?
Well, you know, I like them both, but I think when I write teen novels, I feel like I can take more chances, because I love teen readers, and teens are still like part of our, you know, literary population that are, you know, read like mad, and they still love books, and they also are very open readers, and I feel that I can take chances and be very like emotionally raw when I write for teen readers.
Do they respond? I mean, do you get fan mail, critiques? What comes back from teens? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I do. I do get fan mail, and I get, you know, I have readers that start reading me, you know, when they're 12, and they continue reading me as they grow up, and that's really nice to be in someone's life like that. And I'm also involved with a teen workshop in the summer at Adelphi University, where I went to school as an undergraduate, and there's a week-long workshop for teen writers that they can go to for free if they're recommended. And it's exactly what I would have wanted when I was a teenager.
Hmm. How did you end up becoming a writer? I mean, I know you went to the Stanford program and such, but it had to have started long before that.
I think there's a very, very thin line between readers and writers. And I think, you know, most writers, I think, become writers because they love to read. And then suddenly there's some book that arises inside of them or some story. And they feel that maybe they can, you know, kind of cross over to the other side and be a writer as well.
What's your next project?
My next project, well, I usually don't talk about my next project because, you know, I feel until the book is done, I'm not really sure it's going to work or not. But right now I'm writing a novel that's set within the labor movement in New York City in the early 1900s. And that has been really interesting. I swore I would not do any more research, but it seems that I'm fated to do more.
So like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, the ILGWU, that period?
That period, and my grandfather was a member of the Ladies' Garment Union, and, you know, so I feel like, I want to explore him in a way by exploring this time, because I really didn't know him. I just heard about him, and it's a way for me, you know, in some way to get to know him by knowing these times.
Do you think that would make it another Jewish book, then?
Definitely.
I'm rooting for those.
No, it definitely is.
If you were to give advice, I have a daughter who's 11 who busily writes a book all the time. What advice would you give her?
Well, I think it's really important to be your reader and also to just keep writing. And eventually, I think, you know, it's really great to be in workshops and to be with other writers or people who want to write and to have that kind of shared experience. I mean, I'm a big believer in classes and workshops and, you know, having somebody, you know, really look at your work and help you.
Who helped you the most in becoming a writer?
Well, I had a great mentor. I mean, I had a lot of people help me, but when I went to the Stanford Writing Workshop, which doesn't exist anymore, and I had a professor there, Albert Garrard, who completely, I don't think I'd be a published writer. Certainly, I wouldn't have had the career that I have without him. And I wasn't the only person. He was somebody who really reached out to young writers and really changed their lives. And I think, you know, sometimes, and I really, until he died, which I continued to send him my work. He was my teacher throughout my life.
So kind of your Rebbe in writing.
Yeah, I think it really makes a huge difference if you have somebody behind you, and all you need is that one person who has faith in you.
Has somebody optioned the Dove Keepers for a film?
No, but I wish they would. I think it would make a really good film, actually.
I want to thank Alice Hoffman for a delightful visit here on Too Jewish. You can find out more about her, anywhere. She's got a ton of books out, but The Dove Keepers is really a masterpiece. And Alice, thank you so much. I hope we do it again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the outstanding Judaic Studies professor, Michael Morgan, exploring and explaining modern Jewish thought. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TooJewishRadio.com website. And like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Passover preview. It's Betzeit Yisrael from Safam, When Israel Came Out of Egypt, the Passover Psalm. Hope to see you in just a few moments at Temple Emmanuel here in Tucson, if you're local, for our big post-Purim extravaganza and carnival, 225 North Country Club Road, just north of Broadway. We start at 10 o'clock. My friends, have a great day and a Shavua Tov, a week, we pray, of peace.
Betzeit Yisrael mimitzrayim, Beit Yaakov me'am Eloheis. Hayta Yehuda likadsho, Yisrael mamshilo. Malachai am kitanus, hayarden tishovle.